Chapter 8. Unable to use their original escape route because of the booby-trap explosive that had collapsed the roof of the tunnel, a team consisting of Pitt, Giordino, Egan, Marquez, and two deputies traveled the course Pitt had taken from the Buccaneer mine 24 hours earlier. Relying on Pitt's directional computer for guidance, the men quickly reached a flooded shaft that dropped to the tunnels below and led into the Pandora mine. Pitt stood on the edge of the shaft and stared into the black, ominous water, wondering if this was such a good idea. The flooding had risen 2 mine levels higher than the day before. During the night, the pressure from far below had slowly diminished until the water finally found its level. Sheriff Egan thought he was crazy. Pat O'Connell thought he was crazy, as did Lewis and Lisa Marquez. Only Giordino refrained from calling Pitt crazy, and that was because he insisted on going along as backup in case Pitt ran into trouble. The dive equipment was basically the same as that Pitt used before, except that now he intended to wear a dry suit. The wetsuit had proved practical for movement out of water and protected him from cold during the hike through the mines. But the dry suit was more efficient in insulating the body against the frigid thermal temperatures of the underground water. For the hike back to the shaft, however, he wore warm, comfortable clothing, planning to change into the dry suit only when it came time to go under. Luis Marquez had accompanied the expedition after recruiting 3 of his neighboring miner friends to help carry the dive equipment, which included rope ladders to ease the trip through vertical shafts. Sheriff Egan firmly believed his services would be required to direct a rescue operation that he saw as inevitable. Pitt and Giordino slipped out of their street clothes and, for added thermal protection, pulled on nylon and polyester inner suits that were shaped like long john underwear. Then they climbed into Viking vulcanized rubber dry suits with attached hood, gloves, and traction-soled boots. Once they were suited up, their equipment and gauges checked, Pitt glanced into Giordino's face. The little Italian looked as unruffled and tranquil as if he were about to dive into an 8-foot-deep swimming pool. "I'll guide us with the directional computer and leave it to you to focus on the decompression tables." Giordino held up a decompression computer strapped to his left arm. Figuring an approximate dive time of 30 minutes in water 110 feet deep at an altitude of 10,000 feet above sea level took a bit of prodigious calculation for our decompression stops. But I think I can get you back to this rock garden without narcosis, an embolism, or the bends. I'll be eternally grateful. Pitt pulled on a Mark II full face mask with a built-in underwater communication system. "Do you read me?" he asked Giordino. "Like you were inside my head." They had hauled 10 air tanks into the mine. For the dive, they each carried twin tanks strapped to their backpacks, with a reserve tank clamped in between for a total of 6. The remaining 4 were to be lowered by Marquez and his friends at predetermined depths as reckoned by Giordino's computer for the decompression stops. They carried no weapons except their dive knives.
"I guess we might as well go," said Pitt.
"After you," Giordino replied. Pitt switched on his dive light and beamed it onto the smooth surface of the water. He kicked off from the edge and dropped 5 feet through the air, crashing through the liquid void in an explosion of bubbles. A second explosion quickly followed as Giordino emerged out of the gloom beside him. He made a motion with his hand downward, doubled over, and kicked his fins, heading into the depths of the mine. They swam down, down, their dive lights cutting the black water, revealing nothing but cold, hard rock walls. They went slowly, equalizing the increasing water pressure in their ears the deeper they dove. If they hadn't known they were diving down a vertical shaft, they'd have sworn they were swimming inside a horizontal drainpipe. At last, the floor of the gallery at the bottom of the shaft appeared, the ore cart track rising to meet them, rails mute and cold under their thick film of rust. The turbidity created by the rushing surge after the explosion the day before had dissipated, and the water was calm and clear, visibility reaching at least 50 feet. Pitt checked his depth gauge. The needle stood at 186 feet, and he waited until Giordino leveled out slightly ahead of him.
"How far from here?" asked Giordino.
90 to 100 yards, Pitt answered, pointing. "Just around that bend in the tunnel." He pumped his fins and darted into the tunnel, his light sweeping back and forth through the timbers. They rounded the bend, moving above the curve of the ore cart tracks. Suddenly, Pitt thrust out his arm and abruptly stopped.
"Switch off your light," he ordered Giordino.
His friend complied, casting the tunnel into smothering blackness, but not totally. A dim glow filtered through the water in front of them.
"I think we have poachers," said Giordino.
"Why is it these characters materialize every time I blow my nose?" Pitt groaned. There were two divers inside the chamber, both working with intent and purpose, photographing the inscriptions on the walls. A pair of underwater floodlights stood on stands, illuminating the drowned chamber as dazzlingly as a Hollywood studio stage. Pitt gazed upward through the hole on the floor of the chamber, staying in the shadows so the divers inside wouldn't spot a reflection from the glass plate in his full face mask. He marveled at their efficiency. They were using self-contained breathing units that absorbed and eliminated the bubbles exhaled through their air regulators in order to prevent water disturbance in front of their camera lenses. He was especially careful not to allow his own exhaust bubbles to float through the opening in the chamber floor.
"They're tenacious, I'll give them that," Pitt muttered. "Whatever is in the inscriptions, they want it badly enough to kill and die for it."
"Good thing their communication system is on a different frequency, or they'd have eavesdropped on our conversations."
"Could be they've tuned in and plan on suckering us inside."
Giordino's lips curled into a tight grin behind the mask.
"So do we disappoint them and cut and run?"
"Since when were we ever smart enough to take the easy way out?"
"Never, that I recall."
Giordino's bond with Pitt had never weakened in all their years of friendship, a friendship that went all the way back to the first grade. Whatever scheme Pitt devised, no matter how insane or ridiculous, Giordino was in for a penny, in for a pound, without the slightest protest. They had saved each other's life on more than one occasion, and, when needed, could get inside the other's head. That they worked as a close-knit team went without saying. Their adventures were legendary within Numa.
"It'd be next to impossible for both of us to rush inside the chamber in unison before they react," said Pitt, eyeing the narrow diameter of the opening.
"We could swim inside and knife them in their respective guts," said Giordino quietly.
"If our positions were reversed," murmured Pitt, so softly that Giordino could barely hear him, "that's what they would do to us. But the practical side of me says take them alive."
"Easier said than done." Pitt moved as close as he dared to the opening and peered at the two divers, who were absorbed in their work.
"I think I see an opportunity."
"Don't leave me in suspense," said Giordino, removing his gloves so his hands had freedom of movement.
"They're wearing their dive knives strapped to their lower legs."
Giordino's eyebrows rose questioningly under the mask.
"So are we."
"Yes, but we're not about to be attacked from behind by a pair of genial and dashing rogues." The divers inside finished photographing the inscriptions and star symbols. While one loaded their camera equipment in a large duffel bag, the other began placing a charge of explosives in one corner of the chamber. The procedure played into Pitt and Giordino's hands. As soon as the diver with the camera gear had worked his way through the hole into the cavity below, Giordino snatched the mouthpiece of the breathing regulator from between the man's lips and cut off his air supply. In the same instant, He circled a massive arm around the man's exposed neck, choking him until he went limp from unconsciousness.
"I've got mine," Giordino muttered heavily.
Pitt didn't bother to reply. With a powerful kick of his fins, he shot into the chamber and toward the unsuspecting diver connecting a timer to the explosives. He came in from the side to avoid the air tanks on the diver's backpack. In a repeat of Giordino's performance, he tore away the mouthpiece and squeezed the diver's throat in a vice-like grip. Pitt had not enjoyed the luxury of time, however, to see that he was tackling a man of giant size. It took all of 2 seconds for Pitt to realize he had bitten off more than he could chew. His opponent was built like a professional wrestler and had the muscles of one. He didn't react with helpless inertia, but thrashed around the narrow confines of the chamber like a crazy man in a violent fit. Pitt felt like a fox who had unwittingly leaped onto the back of a wounded bear and was holding on for dear life. The sheer animal power as the man tried to reach over his shoulders and grasp Pitt's head was terrifying. 2 huge hands managed to clutch Pitt around the head. For a few moments, Pitt thought his skull was beginning to crack in 100 places. What saved him from having his brains turned into mush was a beefy wrist that moved beside his jaw. He spit out his mouthpiece, somehow managed to twist his head under the crushing grip, and bit the wrist as hard as his jaws could clamp. A cloud of blood billowed in the water. The hands around his head jerked free in chorus with a painful shout that came as a grotesque gurgle. Pitt held on and squeezed the great bull of a neck with every ounce of his fading strength. In desperation, he ripped the monster's face mask off. The big man threw himself backward toward one wall in a convulsive jerk. Pitt's air tanks clanged against the rock, and the breath was crushed out of him, but his chokehold did not loosen, even by a fraction. He gripped the wrist of the arm around the throat with his free hand and increased the pressure. From behind and to the side, Pitt could not see the other man's face. Whipping his body from side to side like a dog shaking his coat wet with water, the giant tried desperately to find his air regulator and thrust it back in his mouth. But its hose was wrapped around Pitt's arm. Frantically, the man bent forward enough to grab his dive knife from the sheath strapped to his right calf. Pitt had expected the movement and was prepared for it. As the giant reached down, Pitt released the hand holding the arm around his throat, raised it, and jammed a finger in an open eye. The effect was what he expected, what he'd hoped. The gorilla of a man went stiff as a tree and clamped a hand to his eye. In the process, he blindly caught hold of Pitt's hand and slowly, relentlessly, began to bend the index and middle fingers backward. The pain shot through Pitt like a shaft of lightning. The agony of having the bones of the fingers snapped is unlike any other. Excruciating doesn't do justice as a description. Pitt began to see fireworks behind his eyes. He was within a microsecond of releasing his stranglehold and clutching at the hand that was causing him so much torment when he sensed an infinitesimal drop in pressure. The pain was still there, but lessening by tiny degrees. Slowly, almost too slowly, the stabbing pain began to subside as the giant started sucking water in through his open mouth. His movements became uncoordinated and spasmodic. He entered the initial stages of blackout as he began to drown. His face suddenly contorted in fear and panic. Pitt waited several seconds after the big man went limp before he replaced the mouthpiece, forcing air down his victim's throat and lungs. Giordino came halfway through the hole. "What took you so long?"
"The luck of the draw," Pitt gasped between breaths, his heart pounding like a piston inside a cylinder. "I always choose the wrong lane of traffic, the wrong line to stand in at the bank, and the biggest guy in the world to pick a fight with. What about your man?"
"I wrapped him tighter than a silkworm with electrical cord I found on a string of overhead lights." Giordino looked down at the inert form on the floor of the chamber, and the eyes behind the dive mask widened. He stared at Pitt with glowing respect. "Do the coaches of the National Football League know about this guy?" If they did, he'd be a number one draft choice, Pitt said, as his heart began to slow and his breath came evenly. Take their knives and any other weapons you can find. Then find some more electrical cable and let's bind him before he comes around and tears the mountain down. Leave their dive masks off so their vision is blurred. Giordino hogtied the giant diver with electrical cord and dropped him none too gently through the opening into the cleft below. He then removed one or two weights from the belts of both men, so their bodies were slightly buoyant, which made their mass easier to tow back through the tunnel. He also removed their dive knives. On the smaller man, he found a little gun that shot a shaft with a barb on one end. The shaft was propelled by compressed air from a tiny cylinder. While Giordino was concentrating on their prisoners, Pitt removed a large nylon net bag from his weight belt and opened the metal clasp at the top. He stared at the sinister black skull that seemed to stare back through empty eye sockets. He could not help but wonder if a curse came with the skull. What cryptic secrets did it hold? Pitt's idealistic nature was overpowered by his practical side. Though he was a daydreamer, he did not buy into myths and folk tale. If an object or conception could not be seen, felt, or experienced, it did not exist for him. If he wasn't already 180 feet underwater, he would have spit in the eye of the obsidian skull. But because it was a link in a chain of enigmas, he was determined to place it in the hands of people who could properly study it. "Sorry, my friend," he murmured so softly that Giordino didn't hear him. "But it's time you revealed yourself." He lifted the skull very carefully from its pedestal and slid it into the carry bag. At this depth, he handled it easily. But once it came out of the water, he guessed it would weigh a solid 40 pounds. He took one final look at the chamber, the inscriptions on the walls, the still-burning floodlights, lying on the floor where they had been hurled during the struggle. Then he dove headfirst through the hole in the rock, mindful not to knock the skull against the rock and shatter it. Giordino had already pulled the two divers into the tunnel. The giant of a man had regained consciousness and was struggling violently to break free of the electrical cord that bound his ankles and pinned his arms tightly against his immense body. "Need a hand?" Pitt asked. "You carry the skull in the bag with the cameras. I'll tote the refuse." "Best if you go first and I follow. That way I can watch them every inch of the way in case Big Boy starts breaking loose." Giordino handed him the little gun with the barb. "Shoot him in his Adam's apple if he so much as wiggles a finger." "We'll have to be very careful in our decompression stops. We may not have enough air for the four of us." Giordino made an indifferent motion with his hands. "Sorry, I'm not in a sacrificial mood." The return went slowly. Giordino made better time dragging the two divers and their breathing gear by walking over the ore track ties than trying to swim his way back to the shaft. Precious air was lost during the prolonged passage. Pitt kept a close eye on his air gauge. He knew that his air was seriously depleted. The gauge read just 300 pounds. He and Giordino had used twice the amount of air they had computed before the dive, not having counted on a fight with intruders. He curled his body and kicked around to the side of the bound divers, checking their air gauges. Both men had nearly 700 pounds. They must have found a shorter route through the mine to the chamber, Pitt surmised. After what seemed a year and a day, they finally reached the vertical shaft and rose to the first decompression stop. Sheriff Egan and Luis Marquez had lowered two spare tanks on nylon line to the precise depth Giordino had calculated earlier. Keeping a tight eye on his decompression computer, Giordino listened as Pitt read off the air pressure remaining in each tank. Only when they went beyond the safety level did he unstrap and push them aside. The prisoners did not become belligerent. They'd come to realize that to resist was to die. But Pitt didn't let down his guard for a second. He knew well they were two ticking time bombs, waiting to explode at the first opportunity that presented itself for them to escape. Time passed as if mired in glue. They used up the last of their air and went on the reserve tanks. When the prisoners' tanks were dry, Pitt and Giordino began to buddy-breathe with them, exchanging their mouthpieces between breaths. After the prescribed wait, they lazily swam up to the next decompression stop. They were scraping the bottom of the reserve tanks when Giordino finally gave the surface sign and said, "The party's over. We can go home now." Pitt climbed the rope ladder thrown into the shaft by Marquez. He reached the rim of the tunnel floor and handed Sheriff Egan his air tanks. Then he passed up the skull and camera bag. Next, Egan took Pitt's outstretched hand and helped him onto firm rock. Pitt rolled over on his back, removed his full face mask, and lay there for a minute, thankfully breathing in the cool, damp air of the mine.
"Welcome home," said Egan. "What took you so long? You were due back 20 minutes ago."
"We ran into two more candidates for your jail." Giordino surfaced, climbed up, and then knelt on his hands and knees before hauling the smaller prisoner into the tunnel. "I'll need help with the other," he said, lifting his face mask. "He weighs two of me put together." 3 minutes later, Egan was standing over the intruders, questioning them. But they glared menacingly at him and said nothing. Pitt dropped to his knees and removed the dive hood covering the smaller man's head and chin.
"Well, well, my friend the biker. How's your neck?"
The constrained killer lifted his head and spit at Pitt's face, narrowly missing. The teeth were bared like a rabid dog's. Eyes that had seen more than one death glared at Pitt.
"A testy little devil, aren't we?" said Pitt. "A zealot of the Fourth Empire. Is that it? You can dream about it while you're rot in jail."
The sheriff reached down and gripped Pitt's shoulder.
"I'll have to let them go free."
Pitt stared up, his green eyes suddenly blazing.
"Like hell you will."
"I can't arrest them unless they've committed a crime," Egan said helplessly.
"I'll press charges," Marquez cut in coldly.
"What charges?"
"Trespassing, claim jumping, destroying private property, and you can throw in theft for good measure."
"What did they steal?" Egan asked, puzzled.
"My overhead lighting system," Marquez replied indignantly, pointing down at the electrical cord binding the divers. "They've snatched it from my mine."
Pitt placed a hand on Egan's shoulder. "Sheriff, we're also talking attempted murder here. I think it might be wise if you held them in custody for a few days, at least until a preliminary investigation can make an identification and perhaps uncover evidence of their intentions."
"Come on, Jim," said Marquez. "You can at least keep them under lock and key while you interrogate them."
"I doubt whether I'll get much out of this lot."
"I agree," said Giordino, running a small brush through his curly hair. "They don't look like happy campers."
"There's something going on here that goes far beyond San Miguel County."
Pitt peeled off his dry suit and began dressing in his street clothing. "It won't hurt to cover your bases."
Egan looked thoughtful.
"All right, I'll send a report to the Colorado Investigation Agency."
The sheriff broke off as every head turned and stared up the tunnel. A man was shouting and running toward them as if chased by demons. A few seconds later, one of Egan's deputies staggered to a halt and leaned over until his head was even with his hips, panting for breath, exhausted after running from the hotel wine cellar.
"What is it, Charlie?" Egan pressed. "Spit it out."
"The bodies,"
Charlie the deputy gasped.
"The bodies in the morgue."
Egan took Charlie by the shoulders and gently raised him upright.
"What about the bodies?"
"They've gone missing."
"What are you talking about?"
"The coroner says they've disappeared. Somebody snatched them from the morgue."
Pitt looked at Egan for a long moment of silence, then said quietly, "If I were you, Sheriff, I'd send copies of your report to the FBI and the Justice Department. This thing goes far deeper than any of us imagined."